A very good morning. It's Sunday the 30th of June and this is On The Record with Gavin Riley with you until 1 o'clock today. If you want to contact us, do get in touch. There's a variety of ways. You can text us at 53106. That will cost you 30 cents. We are also on News Talk, we're also on Twitter rather, at News Talk FM and at Gav Riley, or you can just use the hashtag On The Record. A busy show on the way as always over the next 2 hours. Our panel in studio this morning, Colm O'Gorman, Executive Director of Amnesty International Ireland and founder of One In Four, Colette Brown, barrister and columnist with the Irish Independent, and Ian Power, Executive Director of Spunout.ie. They'll all be talking to me in just a few moments after I'll guide you through exactly what's on the front page of this morning's newspapers, starting with the Sunday Independent. Cabinet to fast-track price rules on alcohol. This is a story that you heard Ailish talking about on the news just a moment ago. The government is set to fast-track new laws to clamp down on cheap alcohol sales in off-licences and supermarkets, with the Cabinet expected to approve plans within the next 2 weeks. Nice of them to do that just before they go off on the summer recess. The Sunday Independent has also learned that controversial minimum unit pricing rules for wine, beer and spirits will come into effect within 12 months, meaning this is the last summer that consumers will be able to avail of bargain basement alcohol drinks. Philip Ryan goes on to explain, under the new laws, a 75 centilitre bottle of white wine, which currently costs €5.99, would increase by €1.11. 70 centilitres of Tesco Value Vodka, which currently costs €12.99, would increase to €20.71, which is the same minimum price for the similar bottle of gin. A can of Dutch Gold beer, which currently costs €1.13, will increase by 45 cents. So maybe make a note of that if you're going booze shopping. Also on the front page of the Sunday Independent, 45 nursing homes could face closure. Up to 45 state-run nursing homes are in danger of closure because they will fail to meet a deadline to comply with standards enforced by the health watchdog, according to the Sunday Independent. The situation also raises questions over the future care of hundreds of residents. Front page of the Sunday Business Post, meanwhile, talking about the newly erupted row between AIR and the government over whether broadband could have been provided for cheaper. AIR has accused the government of overestimating by 900% the number of homes that would have to pay hundreds of euro for high-speed internet under its alternative national broadband plan. The telecoms firm has rubbished the Department of Communications' claim that as many as 81,000 premises across the country would have to foot huge bills to avail of high-speed fibre broadband under the plan pitched last week. They insist that the real number would be 9,000 as most. Peter O'Dwyer goes on to explain that the reason behind that debate is that the government wants anyone to within 50 metres of the road to be provided automatically to broadband. They say that AIR's alternative plan would exclude 81,000 premises as a result, when AIR says the figure is actually 9,000. Also on the Business Post, Secret Trusts Registry initiative delayed over PPS numbers issue. Ian Guider explaining that a registry of beneficial ownership, which was supposed to go live last weekend and bring a whole new era of transparency as to who is actually running certain trusts, has had to be delayed because a lot of the people who own them don't have PPS numbers and you need a PPS number to be published, which seems like a pretty major flaw in the whole design of that system. Sunday Times, Ireland cannot stop damaging EU beef deal. Ireland will be unable to veto a new EU trade deal with South America, which will lead to 99,000 tonnes of beef coming into the European market, and which the Irish Farmers Association has described as reckless and wrong. Facing demands yesterday to veto the deal with Mercosur, which is the South American trade bloc comprising of Argentina, Brazil, Paraguay and Uruguay, an Irish government official admitted that in all likelihood a veto would not be legally possible. "We may not be in a position to play that card," he said. "The EU does have the power to do these deals unilaterally." That will ultimately have to be approved by the Council of EU Trade Ministers, but Ireland only has about 1.5% of the vote there, so it's very hard for Ireland to try and block that. Also on the front of the Sunday Times, have a break but forget your Kit Kat. Nestle adds to our no deal gloom. Shock horror, says Colin Coyle in a fantastic incident of sub-editing. A no deal Brexit could affect supplies of confectionery, Nestle has warned the Irish government. During a meeting in March between representatives of the company and Orla Quinn, who's the Secretary General of the Department of Business, Nestle said that its Brexit-related concerns include complications related to the importation of confectionery and other foods manufactured in the UK into Ireland and the rest of the EU. Nestle, the biggest food company in the world, owns many of the best-known confectionery brands, including Kit Kat, Aero and Smarties. So it's going to be a Smarties shortage. I would have wanted to know about that before Kit Kat. Maybe that's just me. We'll talk to the panel about their confectionery choices in just a moment, perhaps. Front page of the Irish Mail on Sunday. Bullying claims rattle Fine Gael. A pattern of personal abuse and intimidation is becoming commonplace in Fine Gael, and the party is not dealing with it, current and former members have told the Irish Mail on Sunday. Some of the behaviour would have embarrassed Sinn Féin, members have told headquarters. Their comments come as Fine Gael TD John Deasy tells the Irish Mail on Sunday today that bullying and intimidation is so frequent in Waterford that the party hierarchy has become desensitised by it, and his stance is backed up by the frustrated efforts of party councillors and high-profile female members. Meath councillor Paddy Mead complains that matters as serious as his car being firebombed involving elements of Fine Gael were not dealt with. That's his allegation, at least. He also claims that he was assaulted at a meeting where senior members of the party were present. Really significant stuff. And finally, the front pages of the Irish Sunday Mirror and the Sunday World, both dealing with the plantation of a new tree on the grounds of Leixlip Manor Hotel yesterday in memory of Anna Creagel. It's been planted at one of her favourite spots, and both her parents, Patrick and Geraldine, both said yesterday that Anna was with them in spirit as they planted that tree in one of her favourite hangout spots. So that is a quick tour of what's on the front pages of the Sunday newspapers. One regular photographic theme on the front of the papers is Leo Varadkar and others marching at Pride. Starting with you, Colm O'Gorman, firstly, how is your head after Pride?
My head is grand. I was at home and out for a run at 6 o'clock yesterday evening. I'm at a point now where the Pride ends at the end of the day, and I'm quite happy to get home and wind down a little bit and clear the head.
How did you find the whole thing? How did you find it, particularly given that it's now at its biggest ever and having the likes of the GAA, Máirín na Foirme and An Garda Síochána Síochána as participants in the march?
Yeah, I was thrilled to see Máirín na Foirme taking part. I heard the president of Máirín na Foirme doing a brilliant interview on radio about a week beforehand, and I just thought that was a really remarkable moment. I think the more that we have wider civil society represented in, participating in and engaging with Pride, but hopefully with the ideas that underpin Pride, the better. So I think that was really, really valuable. It's not actually, I was Grand Marshal in Pride, I think, in about 2014, I think, and the Garda Band actually led out Pride that year. So it's the first time, I think, that we've had members of An Garda Síochána march in uniform as part of the parade, but they've been represented at it before. I thought it went brilliantly. The parade was back to its traditional route along O'Connell Street and up around to Merrion Square. It was brilliantly organised. It went off really, really well. That was fantastic. The organisers seemed to have listened to quite a lot of concern from last year's parade with what felt like, and it was certainly how I felt about last year as well, a complete overtaking of Pride by corporate floats and by big corporate presence. And, you know, frankly, that's really not what Pride is meant to be about. So I think it got some of that right this year. I do think there's a need to have a conversation, though, in Ireland right now. I mean, if we're at a point where the LGBT community in Ireland have such soft power that, quite frankly, you know, we now have one of the largest parades in the country happening on an annual basis. And quite rightly, people say, so what is that about? And there's lots that it's still about for the LGBT community. But I think we also have an opportunity to talk about what does inclusivity look like? What does diversity look like? Pride, at its heart, is protest. It's always meant to be political. It's a political moment. So I think we need to reflect on what can Pride say and who can Pride engage in conversations around around notions of equality and inclusivity and human rights.
Ian Power from Spunout.ie, you've been nodding vigorously at Colm's assertion that Pride is still political.
Yeah, absolutely, because I think, you know, and you can see that from the reaction perhaps to last year's and even some reaction to this year's Pride March as well, that, you know, I think what you have is lots of people who are struggling to with the notion that, you know, these corporates can come in and I think take over or at least assimilate themselves into what has always been a protest march. You know, it's only in recent years have we seen, you know, significant advances for the LGBT community. And if you look at Donald Lynch's thesis today, you know, he seems to believe that full equality has been achieved overnight just because of one vote on one issue, when really there's loads of issues still left that are discriminating against LGBT people.
I suppose a lot of people, and actually I say I wasn't around the city centre yesterday afternoon, so I didn't get to witness the parade or the festivities itself, but I was in town a little bit later, and it was striking how many people you saw wearing t-shirts from particularly large tech firms in the city, and they all had the rainbow version of their flags. And I suppose those companies would say that the reason why they want to participate, obviously there's a certain amount of it which is cynical, just chasing the grey pound or whatever, but they would also say that it's important.
You mean the pink pound?
Or the pink, sorry, excuse
me.
Well,
the
grey pink pound, whatever muted dusty rose colour that you get when you mix grey and pink. But that they would say that it's also important for them to have a presence there because it's a sign of encouragement for their own employees, that they can feel like they can be out and proud at work.
I think that's really true, and look, that's why I think it's really important to have people like the guards participating in Pride, because it sends a message throughout out their workforce that actually, do you know what, the hierarchy is accepting and wants to make that statement. But I think what happens is that when there's no, I guess, recognition or cognizance of the struggles that have gone on before, particularly if you think about the Gardaí, for instance, you know, there are lots of people who would have been marching in Pride yesterday who would have come across Gardaí who were openly homophobic and still might in certain parts of the country. Mm. And, you know, for us as well, who would experience perhaps hate crimes on the street that they weren't properly investigated before. Things are getting better now. And that is certainly in no small part to the people like Inspector Paul Franey, who's been leading the charge in the Guards and doing amazing work. But I think there has to be that acknowledgement piece, you know, and without that acknowledgement piece, I think that's why you will see people, you know, being slightly uncomfortable with it and the alternative Pride being organised, which I think is really good because you know, I think a lot of the time people think the LGBT community is a homogenous community that all think the same thing, and we don't. We absolutely do not.
There are political sort of spheres within them.
On the question of the corporate piece, that's a really important point. I mean, so for instance, the two major sponsors of Pride this year were Tesco and Google. Google on YouTube. Mm. YouTube actively monetize hate speech. You know, one of the most concerning examples recently is an LGBT YouTuber who's been relentlessly targeted and harassed by other conservative YouTubers online in the US. And when this came to YouTube's attention, what they did was they shut down the capacity of those YouTubers to monetize their homophobia. Instead, YouTube gets all of the advertising revenue
which
drives.
Which then led to a situation where you had some of Google's own employees trying to encourage the organisers not to accept Google sponsorship, for example.
Exactly. And I mean, I think it's really, really important that we acknowledge the participation of employee groups at Pride. That's really important. And companies that ensure that their workplaces are diverse and inclusive and who put in place non-discriminatory work practices and employment practices, all of that's to be welcomed. But we also have to hold these corporations to account for how they behave as corporations, and Google, Alphabet on Google, on YouTube, and YouTube monetizes transphobia and homophobia, and that has to be called out. And you know, to my mind, frankly, they shouldn't be a sponsor of Pride unless they're prepared to tackle those kinds of issues, because we can't allow corporations to wrap themselves in a rainbow flag in an effort to try to suggest that this means they're ethical and pure and true and good corporations.
I want to come back to Alternative Pride in just a moment, but I want to bring in Colette first. But people wanted to listen to an interview with that Garda who was responsible for it, making sure that the Gardaí were themselves participants in Pride. He was interviewed yesterday morning on News Talk Breakfast by Susan Kuhn. You can go back and have a listen to that. It really is worth listening in. Colette, Brian, we already have a lot of texters asking, where is the heterosexual flag flying above Leinster House?
Oh God, can those texters just go back to bed or
enjoy that curveball?
Turn off the program.
Or every day it flies above it. It's the tricolour.
I mean, this kind of rubbish just drives me absolutely mad. I mean, you have a community who for decades were marginalised, were targeted, were victimised. Their entire sexual identity was deemed to be illegal by the state, and for some people who are advocates of an extreme version of numerous kinds of religion, it still is. And they have this day to celebrate themselves, celebrate their community, and you have these dullards who come out then and try to draw a comparison with the heterosexual community and say that it's like, you know, when you've got International Women's Day. Well, when is International Men's Day? Actually, there is an International Men's Day. Look it up. Yeah. Just Google it, you know. So, I mean, I think it's great that Pride has become such an established kind of day, that so many people, you know, take part in it, that, you know, there's such an atmosphere, kind of positive festival atmosphere around town. But I do think these issues as regards corporate kind of sponsorship, I think they're going to become very problematic, because as Colm was saying, with Google in particular, I think there's an issue as regards hate speech on YouTube. And this is an issue that isn't just being faced by organisers of Pride festivals here. Obviously, it's an issue that's come up most recently at San Francisco in their Pride festival, because Google was a big sponsor there as well.
Ian, you want to come back in on that?
Yeah, I mean, I think it goes to the core of corporate social responsibility, right? If any company says they're doing something or they're they're associating themselves with an issue and they're found to be hypocritical in the way that they actually go about their business, then, you know, that's something worth calling out. And I think that that's what this is about. It's making sure that it's actions, not lip service, that I think the LGBT community want from their employers.
On the topic of that has been raised by some of those textures about the what they might call the heterosexual flag. Well, first of all, I'd like to see it design a heterosexual flag and then maybe consider seeing whether it could be flown over at Leinster House or elsewhere. But people often seem to have some reservations around the theory of a pride parade, because a straight person might say, well, I'm not necessarily proud of my sexuality. It is just what I am, and I happen to be from the majority in those cases. So if they don't see themselves as having any cause to be proud about being straight, they might query why other people feel the need to be proud or have demonstrations about not being straight.
100%, and that goes to the root of the issue, is that they don't have the lived experience that the LGBT community does, and that, you know, you growing up LGBT in Ireland is getting better, but it's still not great. You know, there's still a need for Belong To's brilliant stand-up campaign that they do in schools every year. There's still homophobia around the country that needs to be, you know, eradicated, and it's going to take generations to do that. It's not going to happen overnight. And I think that that's, you know, another piece that goes to what Declan Lynch is talking about today in Sunday Independent, is that somehow it's the LGBT community's job to deal with their own self-loathing, when actually the whole purpose of pride and acceptance and the stand-up week in schools and all of those things is to try to stigmatise, I guess, intolerance, and to try to reverse that issue that is going on.
On that
for
general note
people.
Then, Kieran Cork has possibly posited maybe a middle ground. Isn't it time just to have a parade to celebrate tolerance and inclusion across all different spectrums?
What they actually can do is come along and participate in pride, right? Because that's absolutely what it's about. The fact that it's grown out of and has come from the LGBT liberation movement and the LGBT community. I mean, you know, 60,000 plus 70,000 people participated yesterday in Dublin. They weren't all gay people.
70,000.
They weren't all gay people. Mammoth, they were out to celebrate something, and they were out actually to celebrate diversity and inclusion and joy and solidarity. And on that question of pride and what does pride mean? I mean, the notion that LGBT people are proud of their sexual orientation, I think, really misses the point. What I'm proud of is I'm proud of the fact that as a 53-year-old man, I managed to survive growing up gay in a society that shamed me and criminalized me for who I am.
So I'm proud of the resilience that you've shown to get to that point.
Of my resilience and of my dignity and of my capacity for love. That's gotten me to a point where I can live a life that's full of love and full of purpose and full of joy. And that's something to celebrate. And by the way, I'll celebrate that with anybody, regardless of their sexual orientation.
It's how far the community has come. And I think Ian was making a point earlier about how there's some kind of notion or some perception that because in this country we passed the marriage equality referendum, that everything is kind of hunky-dory now. You know, there are no more problems, there is no more stigma. I mean, you've got huge issues, and in Donan Lynch's piece, actually, he makes reference to a study on LGBT teenagers, and it found that they're twice as likely to self-harm, three times more likely to attempt suicide, four times more likely to experience anxiety or depression. And this was a study that was carried out just 2 years ago, so that's even after the marriage equality referendum. So, I mean, you have issues as regards PrEP, you know, that drug, and it isn't available in this country to prevent the spread of HIV. There's a huge campaign at the moment to try to make that available. And there are lots of other ancillary issues that really, really do need to be highlighted. And I think Pride is very important for that.
And it's still a country where a priest can stand up in a rural parish and preach one of the most homophobic sermons I've heard in years.
But it is also now a country where the bishop will issue a statement afterwards.
Well,
the bishop will issue a statement afterwards where
I call him out and ask that he does. And in his statement, nowhere will he use the word homophobia. He'll talk about, you know, unacceptable, like the language being unacceptable or apologise for the offence. At no point did he call out the blatant homophobia in the speech. That would have been valuable. He didn't do that. And he did it after I called him out publicly and asked him to do it, to be perfectly frank.
Ian.
But it's also a country where, like a year ago, we saw a really vicious, violent attack on two gay men in the Midlands, where the community had to put out a GoFundMe to help one of them get facial reconstruction surgery because he was beaten to a pulp with a hurl. you know, we had lots of attention, quite rightly, last month when a lesbian couple were attacked, or a couple were attacked on a bus in London. Those kind of attacks are not as rare as people imagine they are. They just don't get reported. And if they're not the right kind of people, they often don't get the kind of attention that they deserve.
And in acknowledging that, we still have a long way to go, and we have made some progress. Pride is also about solidarity with other countries that are, you know, where being gay is still criminalized, where young people in countries are being persecuted for their sexuality. And I think if you look at the organizers of Alternative Pride, a lot of those groups were representing people who are living in direct provision in Ireland, who are here claiming asylum because of the persecution that they're experiencing for their sexuality in their home countries. And, you know, so for me, I think there's a lot of reasons to continue with Pride, not just, and also the fact that it's remembrance. You saw on Friday night in Stonewall in New York, a black trans woman stood up to read out a list of names of black trans women who had been killed because of their gender identity. And she was shouted down and made to feel like an inconvenience by the very community that's meant to, you know, protect her. And so I think there's a need not only just for wider society to see Pride and to remember and to support and show solidarity with the community, but also within the community itself. You know, we do have to start to understand the struggles of our colleagues and our friends.
One of the high points for me in Pride yesterday was we were marching with Amnesty, obviously, and we met a young woman from Tanzania, and we asked her, what did Pride mean to her? And she said, well, I just got my papers, so now Pride means freedom. It means I can stay here, and it means that I'm safe. Now, that made me very proud of us, all of us. That made me proud of Ireland, quite frankly, that we're offering that kind of protection to people.
Grania in Wexford has texted in 53106 and spent 30 cents in doing so to say, OMG, a heterosexual flag? For the love of God, do people not know their history? Big white heterosexual man, she's capitalised those words, which I like, who has dominated the world, needs to recognise that that autocratic power is diminishing, very slowly, but diminishing nonetheless. Colm, I also want to talk to you about the viewing platform on O'Connell Street, the idea that we've kind of borrowed the St. Patrick's Day model, where you have the dignitaries sat up and observing all the people going by. Yeah. And the way you're giggling, it suggests that you're not entirely wild about being asked to do so.
Well, no, I'm just laughing because there was a bit of a moment when we were coming down O'Connell Street and I suddenly saw the viewing platform and went, God, what's that? This isn't St. Patrick's Day. And it just jarred a little bit. And just to be really clear, this is not a criticism of the people who are on the platform or even particularly that it was there. But it suggests to me that the organisers, whilst they got an awful lot of things right this year in recognising that perhaps they needed to try to rethink what Pride is meant to be about
they
and
kind
reconnect.
Of establishmented it too
but like
much.
The Pride is meant to be about, it's egalitarian. It's meant to be about participation. If you want to come and join in, come and join in. But the notion that we would have dignitaries on a platform watching the parade as it goes by just jars a little bit, I think, with the idea of what Pride is meant to be. I mean, it's great that Leo Varadkar at the age of 40 was at his third Pride, as he said in the paper yesterday, that he seconded this Taoiseach. It's brilliant actually that for decades a whole number of us worked for years to get to a point where actually a politician could come out and not be destroyed by that, and that he was able to do that in 2015. That's grand. That's valuable. But Pride it's meant to be egalitarian. It's meant to be inclusive.
Well, on that general point about the discomfort with the viewing platform, and I'll go through ads shortly, but I just want to get this one point in. There's a piece on page 3 of the Sunday Times about the discomfort that some people felt seeing the Gardaí marching in uniform, because they felt that the whole the ethos of Stonewall ultimately being a riot, and that Pride being a political protest, was slightly undermined by then the rainbow washing of the Gardaí being there and then the Alternative Pride parade coming in. And I suppose some people might think, Colette, that you would think that perhaps if the Gardaí were taking part in this march, then the political purposes that Pride was looking to, you know, put in place 35 years ago have been to some degree achieved. And some people might wonder then why you need to have another splinter movement to the side of it.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a difficult one, because I think there has, I mean, anybody who's listening to Joe Duffy's Liveline programme last week, he had a lot of people who were calling in. There was people who had worked in the Guards in the 1980s and had been virulently targeted and discriminated against and essentially been forced out of their jobs, and there was no recompense for them. And, you know, lots of them had never spoken about the issue before until they went on the programme. And then you kind of juxtapose that with kind of the modern Ireland Ireland, and you know, the inclusion of the Guards in the Pride March for the first time. And I think there are arguments on both sides. I think it's a positive step generally, because it shows, you know, how far we've come, how society has come, that, you know, being gay in the Guards is no longer, you know, a toxic thing. The way that the Guards treat the LGBT community, hopefully, that we, you know, has obviously improved. But then also that you do have, I mean, I'm sure that there are some people who remain in the force who are still homophobic. I'm sure that there are some within the LGBT community who still have bad experiences with the Guards. And it's how do you kind of balance those two things and promote one while still kind of maintaining a level of understanding and empathy with those people who kind of have a bit of a problem with the way things are going.
Like, it was wonderful to see Garda Niall O'Connor on the news last night, because, you know, he was, you could see in his face how much it really meant for him to see the Guards marching in Pride. And I think that sends a huge message out to all of those Guards rank and file about what the higher levels think about inclusion and diversity. And I think that's a really strong message. I think Colette's point is well made in that it's just that we can't forget the history. You know, we have to remember, you know, people's lived real experiences with the Guards in the last number of decades, and just, you can understand why some people just wouldn't feel very comfortable about it happening at this point in time.
I came out in 1984, so I think, to paraphrase Quentin Crisp, I'm now one of the stately homos of Ireland. and like, I can remember being in the Hirschfeld Centre, the NGF, which used to be back at the Central Bank, that, you know, the building that David Norris provided to the community and built an incredible community space when there was nowhere for us to go. And that place saved my life. Like, I found that place when I was street homeless in Dublin, over a period of about 9 months, and it saved my life and helped me to find myself. It was an extraordinary space. But I can remember being in that place on the nights that it ran discos, and, you know, used to volunteer to work in the coffee shop because we weren't allowed to have a drinks license in the place. We could only serve coffee, and I'd volunteer to work in the coffee shop to get in there. But the Guards would come in and walk around the building and look at people and occasionally take names and addresses. And it was all about intimidation. It was all about, like, oppression and bullying. It was vile. And all I can say is, to see the Guards march in that parade yesterday meant something to me. It meant an awful lot to me when it was the Garda band there 4 years ago. It was fantastic to see it yesterday, both in terms of serving members of the Garda force who could be out and be themselves fully, but also a force that at the very least was sending a really important message across its organisation. Now, absolutely, there will be ongoing concerns, but what we have to do now is take that level of engagement and commitment and hold them to it. So now the Garda on Garda Síochána have to be held to the commitment that they've made to respect diversity and inclusion across their force, to root out any elements of homophobia or transphobia or biphobia that still exist there, and to address it. They can be held to account on that. Engagement is always a good thing, provided it's honest and open and constructive and challenging.
One housekeeping matter, just about Ian mentioning that PrEP, but one person has stressed that it is now available in Ireland. They work in a pharmacy in Cork. They supply PrEP to many proud customers. So just to make it clear that PrEP is available as a kind of a HIV containment method.
It is available, but it's not free. So what we're waiting for, and Simon Harris has made huge progress on this, and HICWA have done their assessment of it, and it looks like a PrEP program will begin this year. So I think PrEP is prohibitively expensive if you don't have access to it for free. So you can absolutely get it at the moment, but it is quite pricey to maintain it as a program.
I am way over time and due a commercial break. When we're back, Donald Trump says that it's been an important statement and a great honour to stand on the soil of North Korea, and Vladimir Putin says liberalism is dead. We will ask our guests to refute that idea after the break. Welcome back. 32 minutes past 11. Gavin Riley with you on the record. Still joined in studio by my panel, Ian Power, Colette Brown and Colm O'Gorman. There's a lot written in the papers this week about the G20, which has gotten over a lot of people's eyes. But it's not necessarily the G20 itself that has prompted a lot of the coverage. It's rather an interview that Vladimir Putin gave to the Financial Times in the wake and the run-up of the G20, where he prescribed liberalism to be dead. Ian Power, you kind of almost rolled your eyes there a little bit about the idea of, oh, Putin's offered it again. But he might have a point, because it seems that in a lot of places around the world, sometimes we like to think that the populist wave is over because the likes of Marine Le Pen didn't get elected in France, but that there is this ongoing surge of authoritarianism and liberalism seems to be, to a certain degree, kind of dying at his feet.
I mean, I would disagree. I mean, I think if you look at the issue of climate action as an example, you know, it's where, you know, millions of citizens are getting engaged with the political issue around the world and forcing change to happen. I don't think it wholesale liberalism is dead.
But it is faltering a bit.
I don't know. I mean, I really enjoyed Donald Tusk, who has, you know, come to be the person who we've enjoyed, you know, delivering a strong rebuttal to many things over the last couple of months. But I enjoyed his comments that whoever claims liberal democracy is obsolete also claims that freedoms are obsolete, that rule of law is obsolete, that human rights are obsolete. And he said what he really finds obsolete is authoritarianism, personality cult, and the rule of oligarchs, even though he said he conceded that has
effective in
some cases.
Which, I suppose, is an obvious feedback from someone who grew up as a child of communist Poland, though, that he's kind of seen the dark side of things and he quite likes the accepting tone that the world has adopted under his watch.
Yeah, for sure. And I think that, you know, for young people, particularly across the world, you know, authoritarianism is not something that is particularly appealing. And I go back to that point about climate action. I think that you will find that young people don't believe in what you'd be, I guess you're not surprised, really, that they don't agree with Vladimir Putin's thoughts on the subject.
Colm, I suppose that the reason why this is all notable is because there was that famous declaration in 1992 that because liberal democracy had basically, inverted commas, won, the Cold War was over, the Western side had won, they called it literally the end of history, and that it might have been a bit premature because 27 years down the line it turns out that there's still a lot of space for right-wing thinking. But what is it, do you think, that has proven liberalism to be so frail in some parts of the world, and is it only a temporary aberration, or do you think that the tide is now going the other way?
Well, I don't think liberalism is frail. I think that political leadership is lacking in delivering what liberalism was meant to deliver in the first place. I mean, I really welcome what Donald Tusk had to say. I welcome the fact that the Sunday Independent, for instance, ends an editorial by saying this year that the true solution is to be found in freedom and the rule of law and in human rights. But I think we have to be critical of liberal democracies, or certain liberal democracies, where actually they don't live by the standards that they set themselves. I mean, you know, I work for Amnesty International, a human rights organisation. We didn't invent human rights, but we exist because we are looking to try to get governments to comply with the laws that they wrote when it comes to human rights. So the challenge for many liberal political systems is the fact that at the level of political leadership, they're not delivering on human rights. So it's fantastic to hear Donald Tusk talk about human rights in the European context, but the European Union is not delivering on the commitments and the promises that it made when it comes to human rights. Look at social rights issues across Europe, for instance, on housing, on health, on education. Neoliberalism and a market-driven approach has somehow tried to paint those areas of rights as if they're somehow not rights at all in the first place, and people are being unreasonable if they have certain, frankly, minimum expectations of the kind of lives they should live, lives with a minimum level of dignity guaranteed and protected by the rule of law. So the rule of law is an important point, and human rights are incredibly important. But Europe is not complying with the rule of law. I mean, for instance, you have Orban in Hungary, who has been grossly violating European human rights law for a number of years, and Europe is only edging towards holding Hungary to account for that. You're seeing the same thing now increasingly happen in Poland, in parts of the Czech Republic. There's serious concerns about some things that are happening in Austria as well. I mean, you have homelessness at one point being made a crime in the constitution in Hungary. You're seeing people who try to assist refugees or migrants across Europe being criminalised.
Do those things happen because the European Union is seen as not doing enough? That, of course, you're going to have the rise of someone like Orban in Hungary if the European Union isn't able to live by the values that it set for itself, that they then see that the EU is all bark and no bite, and they want to go for someone who's a little bit more bite.
We see, I think it comes back to a failure of political leadership. So it's really important that people make grand statements at times and make these commitments to human rights and the rule of law, but it's more important that they follow through on them. So if we were to see the European fundamental, the charter of fundamental rights for the European Union being applied right across Europe, if we were to see the rights set out in the social rights charter being applied across Europe and governments being held to account for that, then we would see, I think, a really meaningful impact for people in their lives. But of course, it's understandable that people become disenchanted and angry and upset when their lives become more frantic, more chaotic, more harried, more difficult, more challenging, and where they see wealth being sucked up from across society into a tiny proportion of people at the very, very top, and we're told somehow that that's liberal democracy working. It isn't.
Colette, do you have anything to say on that, or do you want to move on to the increasing cost of Tesco Value Gin, which is something that has got a lot of people exercised already on the text machine this morning, particularly with the news on the front page of the Sunday Independent that with the new minimum alcohol pricing, which was passed into law over a year ago but is now going to take effect in about a year's time, meaning that the minimum price of a can of beer will become €1.58, the minimum price of a bottle of vodka or gin becomes €20.71, and the minimum price of a bottle of wine becomes €7.10.
I only drink craft gins these days, anyway, so I couldn't possibly comment on the Tesco own brand stuff. But yeah, look, I have reservations about this because, like, I've just come back from a holiday in France, and there you can buy a really, really good bottle of wine in any off license that you go to for €3 or €4. And, you know, it's not poison. Mm. And you don't see people staggering around on the streets, and people aren't vomiting at 2 a.m. And the association between the price of alcohol and the behaviour of some people, I don't know, is something that I'm kind of struggling a bit. Now, I know that this has come in Scotland, and there seems to be some early indications that maybe it is having an impact here. But, like, the level of alcohol that Irish people are consuming has been going down for some time. I just looked it up earlier, according to the WHO.
Yeah, it's been on decline for about 15 years.
It's fallen by 25% since 2005, and the average amount of alcohol that adults consumed in 2017, according to data that Revenue has, was down 1.4%. So it's not as if people are, you know, going out and getting hammered constantly, or maybe some people are, but a smaller proportion of people seem to be, because the average alcohol consumption across the country seems to be going down without this measure being brought in. And I know some people have said, look, this is only going to target the kind of really cheap stuff, the really cheap beer that, you know, supermarkets run as loss leaders. It won't really impact, you know, everybody else on a grand scale, but, you know, I still have reservations about it. I think it's a bit nanny-stated.
Thanks to the person who texted into 53106 to say, gosh, those alcohol price rises are enough to drive us to drink. But on a serious note, Ian Power, I saw some figures this week that the European Commission often keeps track of how much cigarettes and alcohol cost across the European Union. We already have the dearest alcohol in the European Union. If it's not really affecting, well, it's affecting consumption that bit because it seems to be going down. But if there's a certain resilience to it, then minimum alcohol price is not going to do much. It's just going to mean that people are paying a little bit more to have pre-drinks, aren't they?
Well, it's actually going to be quite effective. So this bill was one of the longest running, I think, in the last Dáil. It started in December 2015. It only was actually signed into law by the President last October. And, you know, we didn't have a date for commencement for minimum unit pricing until today, which is great. So within 12 months is wonderful. Minimum unit pricing is evidence-based, right? It's not just something that was thought up of on the back of an envelope. And minimum unit pricing, what it does is it raises the floor below which alcohol can be sold. So we're not talking about, you know, your Hendrix here or anything else like that. What we're talking about is those brands that are quite cheap, that do taste like paint stripper, and that are being consumed in high volumes by people who are at risk or by young people. And so what we're doing here is we're raising that floor below which alcohol as a unit cannot be sold. And let's be clear about it, 3 people in Ireland die every day because of alcohol related harm. So from our perspective, you know, that's 1,000 people a year. And
but why doesn't the government just invest in rehab facilities and treatment and stuff? Because, like, I'm aware that there are very few beds. If someone who presents with alcoholism, they want to get treatment, it's very hard for them to do that. And instead a measure like this is brought in, which I don't know, I mean, you say, Ian, that it's evidence based, but the evidence, as far as I'm aware, seems to be pretty thin on the ground. I know we've had this study from Scotland, but I mean, the law hasn't been in there for a very long time, so I think it's really too early to make any.
It's not just based on minimum unit pricing. It's not just based on minimum unit pricing where it has been implemented, but rather the elasticity and harm of price versus health.
But
and
I mean,
look, I think your point is well made in that we don't have enough beds for rehab, but that's not to say that this issue is all about addiction. It's not. It's about the low level of consumption over a long period of time that can cause cancer. So it's not to say that people are dying because of alcohol poisoning, but rather that people are dying because of cancer is caused caused by, you know, 500 people a year will develop some sort of cancer as a result of our alcohol consumption. And it's something that we have to tackle, because culturally, yes, we'd love to live like a country like Spain or France. I was in Estonia last weekend. Amazing wines, very cheap, and they seem to have a decent relationship.
Well, why can't
with
we
alcohol?
Have that society? I want that society. Why can't we
have that decent relationship with alcohol?
Yeah, I think it's interesting to observe that the amount of alcohol that people are drinking is increasingly going down. And I mean, to pull this back to where we started from, I remember being at Pride about 4 years ago and being horrified by the number of teenagers that staggered away from Pride, despite the fact, by the way, that alcohol is banned. You're searched on the way and you can't bring alcohol into the event itself. The number of kids who were coming along and treating Pride as another opportunity to get fallen down drunk in the streets was extraordinary. I saw none of that yesterday. Like, that's over. That's gone. I think there's been quite a significant shift in attitudes towards drinking in Ireland. And we're seeing that, I think, stacked up in the figures in terms of the amount of alcohol consumption. I don't know enough about the data or the evidence to back this one up. But I do think that it's pricing alone is, I don't think it, frankly, my sense is it's not going to address this. People will still drink. I think, by the way, it's staggering that supermarkets can sell a can of beer cheaper than they can sell a small bottle of water. Either that or water companies. Water companies charging £2 for, like, you know, half a litre of water are really ripping us off big time, and fair juice to them.
It's also a sad day, I suspect, for any students who might be listening who thought that the days of being able to get 6 cans of Dutch Gold for €7 or 6 Tuborg for 6 are now going to be over, that it's going to be close to a tenner for a six pack.
Well, as the father of a college-going kid who will kill me if she hears me say all of this, it is actually about the own brand spirits in particular that are consumed in quantities before people go out. I mean, that's where that's coming from. So we'll hit that.
Absolutely. And I come to this with the experience. I was deputy president of the Students' Union UCC between 2009 and 2010. And we had 12 alcohol-related deaths from young people in that calendar year, in that academic year. So one a month.
12.
Where we were going to a funeral of one of our students that had died because of alcohol poisoning or something else. And there were loads of examples where cheap alcohol and access to cheap alcohol was resulting in really difficult life outcomes for young people. So, I mean, for me, this is about the thin end of the wedge. Mm. It's about the cheap availability of alcohol. It's not going to affect anybody who's enjoying a nice cocktail or, you know, out enjoying their branded
I don't know, because
gin and tonic.
When the minimum price of alcohol goes up, you know, won't there necessarily be a kind of an impact on every other price? So if the minimum level goes up, doesn't that mean that the knock-on effect of that is that everything else must go up as well to reflect the fact that the minimum price has gone up?
Just before we go any further, I will come back to that, but obviously just to stress that the tragic deaths of those 12 people in Cork, obviously we're not linking that to any particular brand or any particular problem.
No,
it's just to the general theme of alcohol consumption, just to make that perfectly clear. You are though right, though, Colette, because I'm fascinated what happens to the premium brands, because if a premium brand of whiskey is suddenly able to charge...
If it's no longer priced as a premium...
If it's no longer any dealer than the entry level minimum, then do they end up raising their prices? Well, I actually really want to know. Maybe people can text in on that 53106. Let us know whether the extra money is going to be absorbed as some sort of tax revenue. Does the brewery end up just raising its price? Does the duty end up getting raised? Does the supermarket cream it off? Because if you're currently able to sell a bottle of vodka for €15 and now it's going to be €21, I'd love to know where the other six is going.
Because the other option is that people won't buy the cheap muck anymore and they'll buy the halfway decent stuff that costs, you know, not an awful lot more than the inflated price of the cheap muck.
Well, if the cheap muck costs the same as the good stuff now, I'm no marketing guru, but I'd imagine that the people who want to maintain the notion that they have a premium brand are going to raise prices accordingly.
Speaking of things that some people think of as cheap muck and other people think as premium content, we're going to be talking about Love Island when we're back after this.
Boom.
Quite a few texts coming in about our previous discussion on minimum alcohol pricing. One text just says, some of your guests probably aren't mixing within a social circle that includes a lot of problem drinkers. I know people, particularly older single men, who are drinking at home every night, dying in their 50s, and they have no interest in rehab. And Neil in Wicklow, who says he likes a pint and a glass of wine, says, dream on, lads. Just spent a week in the west of Ireland and was disturbed at the levels of alcohol consumption among young people in their 20s. Someone else also points out that if this isn't done at the same time in the north, it will do massive damage to the retail retailers in smaller towns and border regions who are already struggling, which is a very fair point. Breaking news, gold for Ireland. Kurt Walker beats Miloka Butsenko by unanimous decision to take bantamweight gold at the European Games in Minsk, which is great news. Congratulations, Kurt. We might talk to Neil Tracy about that in a little while. But my producer is telling me that I can use that to segue into the fate of another boxer, Tommy Fury, who is starring in Love Island, which might be among the clumsiest segues I've ever done on this slot. But look, here we are. Whenever I tweet about Love Island, I get flooded, Colette, with replies being like, what are you doing wasting your time watching Love Island? And I'm aware that I'm among people here who do not watch Love Island, but there's an awful lot of cultural snobbery out there for people who think that this is beneath them.
Yeah, well, I don't watch it, but I've also muted any reference to it on my social media platform, so I never see any stories about it. I just have no interest in it. But at the same time, I'm not one of these people who would necessarily respond to a tweet that you had posted saying, oh, yeah, why don't you do something better with your time? Look, it's bubblegum TV. It doesn't take itself too seriously. I hope the people who watch it don't take it too seriously either. Each to their own. Well, I just have absolutely no interest.
So what you're saying is that you're now in the minority who are still watching the 9 o'clock news instead of Love Island on Virgin Media 2. I should say, you know, other channels are available, but I am going to promote Virgin Media, because we learn on page 3 of the Mail on Sunday today, Ian, that 3 nights out of the last 4 this week, more people have watched Love Island than the 9 o'clock news on RTE. What does that tell us about people?
I mean, it tells us that people are looking for something to unwind with and watch that's particularly mindless. The only reason I don't watch Love Island is because I know I would love it and would end up watching it all of the time. And I've got
exams next
week. I
feel the same about Star
week.
Wars. I've never seen any of the Star Wars, and I'm sure it's because I would become that guy who's complaining about the structural integrity of the Death Star or something like that.
Indeed, yeah. There's nothing better than something like Love Island.
I think that's the most shocking thing I've ever
off.
Heard on this programme, actually. You've never watched Star Wars.
Or any of the Star Treks or any of the spin-offs, because I just know that I would become that guy.
Go there.
Oh my god.
Don't encourage me. Even the producer is now screaming in my ear asking about what sort of terrible, like, you know, terrible person I am. Colm, on a serious note, I'm aware that you haven't been watching the show, but there's been a lot said in the last couple of days about Maura Higgins, who's a contestant from Longford, who has become something of a feminist icon because she has openly discussed about how much she enjoys sex and how much she would like to be having sex with some of the other housemates. And then when the opportunity arrives and some of the other housemates then basically suggest that she's going to have sex, that she's entitled to stand up for herself and say, actually, no, that it's one thing to enjoy sex, it's another thing to be an easy lay.
As I understand it, it's when the lads in the house decide that on the basis that she talks about sex quite a lot, that means that she's easy and would be up for it, that she immediately rejected that and pushed back on that and fair dues to her. My problem with
Are you
Love
sure I- you haven't been watching it?
My daughter does watch it, and unfortunately I think
happen to be in the room on some occasions.
No, she retreats with her laptop to another room in disdain because I stand there looking at her and shaking my head whenever she does, and trying not to be judgmental but feeling very judgmental about the whole thing. The reason, by the way, why I'm judgmental about it is not necessarily because of who's involved or what it is, but actually because of what it is and how it's constructed. Every single moment on that show is, there's nothing spontaneous about it. It's all produced to the nth degree. Everything that they do, everything that they say, everything we see of Maura, this is a narrative that's been driven by producers behind the line who are presenting it as a picture that's going to hook us in as much as possible to create as much drama as we possibly can. There's nothing real about that kind of reality.
Maura, actually, from your description, just seems to me to remind me of Samantha from Sex and the City, actually. So, I mean, we had our feminist icon back then.
A point, maybe it's kind of a rehash of that. On Colm's point though, Ian, it probably is important that people do understand that a lot of what they see here is being,
all
of what they see is being contrived in some way, and that they're not looking at it purely in this sociological petri dish perspective, that they do understand that it is engineered entertainment.
And I think people know that now. I think people know that all reality franchises have entire elements of engineering about them, whether they're partial or full. And I think it links actually back to a really cool piece that I saw on Joe.ie yesterday about Treasure Island, which was the reality show that we did in 2001, 2002, and how that was rigged by the producers, and the producers threatened to sue allegedly.
It's a very important word there.
And threatened to sue the participants at the time, and what an interesting kind of dynamic that was when we first started to learn that reality TV was somewhat coordinated, because obviously it has to be. Tonight I understand that there's going to be a new batch of people put into the other villa while the others are in the other villa, so that there's new fresh meat for people to talk about.
I think we said chilling the waters out.
In Roman times, they had, you know, the gladiators, and they had, you know, lion fighting and stuff. And in the modern era, we have Love Island, where, you know, fresh
people
meat.
With veneers and six packs.
And we also have the news on Virgin Media 2 afterwards, which we also learned by the Sunday Business Post is doing really well. And that is, of course, entirely down to the integral news storytelling that you'll see on Virgin Media News every day of the week, as well as just the entertainment value of Love Island. Lads, we're out of time. I have to let you go. But thank you all for coming in of a Sunday morning. Colette Brown, barrister and columnist with the Irish Independent. Ian Power, who's the CEO of Spunout.ie. And Colm O'Gorman, Executive Director of Amnesty International Ireland. Thank you all very much.